Good morning, everyone. Broadcasting from Kameno Island, it's been an interesting few days. I find it fascinating the way that God operates through this form. Oftentimes, he pours such tremendous power, energy through the spine and this brain. You'd think that it would be enough to provide electricity and power for cities. And yet, he doesn't give hardly more than what it takes to maintain this body, its heartbeat, its blood flow, etc. So this is the way that he works through this form. And I gladly accept what he gives me. But I wish I was with you in person today. But we'll be with this in this way, with each other in this way. God has been having me work on a writing for the last few days. Before I get into that, our dear Barbara Lutz has been in really tough shape the last couple of days, and she's been in for an operation on her brain, two operations now, for a brain tumor. She's one of Mother's earliest disciples, dating back into the early 1960s. She had earlier ones in the 50s, but Barbara is an early one, and a wonderful soul. And Mother oftentimes talked about the tremendous spiritual experiences that Barbara is going through. And she has been and continues to be an inspiration for many. So to keep her in your prayers, she had a brain tumor and it was operated on. And they discovered that there was blood in the brain, it was bleeding. And they went back in and they operated again. And now they're saying that it's possible that she could have very good recovery in the next couple of days. So let us keep her in our prayers. Send her God's healing light and love. And see her as she truly is, perfect in him. So God has been having me work on this writing. It's very interesting, and it's entitled Wisdom Quotient. I would like to talk to you today about that. First reading from this writing. IQ, intelligence quotient, is a measurement of a person's reasoning ability, often equated with the notion, if you are intelligent and educated, then you are wise. However, there are many types of intelligence. Reasoning and recall of large knowledge base is just one of them. In addition to reasoning intelligence, there is also emotional quotient, socialization quotient, wisdom quotient, and God quotient. Emotional quotient is having full access to a wide range of feelings and the ability to process them as they arise. Socialization quotient is measured by the ability to connect with others, display empathy, and be a follower or a leader, depending on circumstances. Wisdom quotient is knowing what is true and discerning right action. And God quotient is the faculty for experiencing higher consciousness and helping others to do the same. Although all these types of intelligences are important, and many have not been studied scientifically, the wisdom quotient has been of particular interest to me, as it is essential for real success in all other fields. Wisdom and discernment are sometimes associated with a high IQ. The smartest person in the room will have the right answers in all areas of life. However, while this may be true for answering standardized test questionnaires, it is hardly proof for finding one's way through life's many bewildering situations, its vagaries, seemingly unsolvable problems, and moral dilemmas. For knowing what is true and right action, discerning wisdom is the most important faculty available for any individual and and can be quite independent of being a brainiac. A study of who may be the three most prominent individuals of the American Revolution reveals much about discernment. Washington, Jefferson, and Adams were all highly intelligent and successful individuals. Adams and Jefferson were both brilliant and in all likelihood would outscore Washington on an IQ test, and perhaps Jefferson would top all three. However, both Jefferson and Adams could not have played the role Washington did, nor did they display the consistent decision-making ability that made the American Revolution not just an overthrow of a government, but gave birth to a true revolution of ideas and a subsequent successful democratic republic. Washington was the one indispensable man. Learning discrimination came early in Washington's life. For self-study, he copied Rules of Civility based on a Jesuit writing from the 1595, whose first rule is respect for others. Such early adherence to right behavior built a foundation for true discernment later in life, not based on rules alone, but a sense of knowing right action based on intuition. Access to what the great Yogi Milarepa called inborn Dharma essence. Inborn Dharma essence. Learning rules of good behavior is a good step, but it should lead to a search for truth that is to be found within. And while the reasoning mind may be helpful in this pursuit, its acquirement requires a more subtle faculty, a direct apprehension through intuition for right action that ultimately comes from the divine mind. Washington was not the most brilliant tactician or strategic general of his times, but he knew that holding together his army on the field was absolutely needed, not a desperate all-or-nothing battle, as lesser generals were urging at the time. Also, as general, he did not afterward proclaim himself dictator king, as some urged him to do, but voluntarily disbanded the army he had successfully and at great expense built in the previous 6 years. President Washington demonstrated selfless integrity as he performed all the duties of the office without a template and doing everything for the first time. As the first head of a constitutional republic, he did something absolutely unique up until that moment in history. Washington voluntarily stepped down from power without giving it over to an heir, to a newly democratically elected president. I use Washington as an example because he is prominent, showed the right temperament, and performed right action as Virginia's representative, as military general, and as the first president. All done with the least education of any president since, yet universally was accorded absolute respect from all who knew him. Wisdom and discernment that escaped others around him, whom I sure would score higher on an IQ test, demonstrates the superiority of wisdom to reasoning and superior knowledge base only. Another example is found halfway around the world in the person of Ramakrishna Paramahansa. A saint held in high repute for his realization of God, Ramakrishna received very scant education, but nevertheless pursued God realization with his whole might. His words were recorded most notably in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna by Master Mahasya. Without reading or writing skills, Ramakrishna etched for the ages remarkable wisdom from stories of his own life experiences and through Indian tales that he brought into relevant context through his talks with devotees. His ability to bring out great truth earned through his intense spiritual practice, his wisdom on parade, and in truth is today regarded as scripture. Ramakrishna put to shame pundits and those well-known and much more accomplished in the world of his day. He continues to shine for the ages. Some seem to have discernment from the very beginning, despite all other factors in life. Ramakrishna, Anandamoyi Ma, Meher Baba, and other greatly realized masters were thought to be mentally defective when young, because they were attuned to a higher reality the world simply does not see. Yet, because their words and life activities are based in higher truth, their lives have only gained strength through time, even as the great masters, Jesus, Buddha, and Krishna have done. We do not need to denigrate the value of education or a high IQ to acknowledge the superior value of true wisdom. Let us seek out wisdom. In the beginning, this may well be based on reason, then later from inner attunement and communion with the greater self. In a reciprocal manner, right action leads us into greater attunement with higher consciousness. Higher consciousness then becomes a direct guide for right action. As long as the individual remains mindful of both right action and inner attunement, the growth of both makes for the seamless life of wisdom and intuitively guided right action. Master quotes, I thought, I knew that he spoke about Washington, and both he and Papa have at different times, as well as Mother. And so I thought I would read to you what Master quoted about Washington. Among respected accounts of the current age is the experience of George Washington, a revelation bestowed on him by a heavenly being during dark days of the American Revolution in the year 1777. His was a vision of a future of a great nation arising on the American continent, an angel, quote, a singular, beautiful female, appeared to him. A new influence, mysterious, potent, irresistible, took possession of me. Everything about me seemed to rarefy, the mysterious visitor herself becoming more airy and yet more distinct to my sight than before. I heard the voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." A remarkable scene of a dark, shadowy being, like an angel standing or rather floating in midair between Europe and America, unfolded in a vision representative of the American Revolution and America's ultimate victory. Similarly, a second vision unfolded, predicting the Civil War. And again, I heard the mysterious voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." And this time, a third vision of a great conflict was revealed to him. The dark shadow angel placed his trumpet once more to his mouth and blew a long, fearful blast. Instantly, a light of 1,000 suns shone and pierced and broke into fragments the dark cloud which enveloped America. At that same moment, the angel upon whom the head still shone and the word Union, which bore our national flag in one hand and a sword in the other, descended from the heavens, attended by the legions of white spirits. These immediately joined the inhabitants of America, who were well nigh overcome, but who immediately taking courage again, closed up their broken ranks and renewed battle. Again, amid the fearful noise of conflict, I heard the mysterious voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." As the voice ceased, the dark cloud rolled back, together with the armies it had brought, leaving the inhabitants of the land victorious. I found myself once more gaping upon the mysterious visitor, who, in the same voice I had heard before, said, "Son of the Republic, what you have seen is thus interpreted. These great perils will come upon the Republic. The most fearful is the third, which is the whole world united, shall not prevail against her. Let every child of the Republic learn to live for his God, his land, and Union." And that's condensed from Washington's vision in the National Tribune of 1880. As we grow in our spiritual union with God, we commune with him deeply. And when we do, we feel his presence residing within us. It comes with a great sense of peace. It can be the opening of the heart with divine love that is universal, that is for one and for all. It is an unfoldment within the brain. It is described as the thousand-petal lotus, or in Revelations, it's described as the thousand years of peace that comes with the coming of the Christ. And this is the Christ intelligence that comes to us. It shows us revelations. It shows us perhaps things to come. It shows us the truth of who and what we truly are in God. Most people live on this earth and they just simply open their eyes when they wake up in the morning and they see this world, and their whole life, their whole energy is given to this world. And some who try to lead a good life and they go to church on Sundays, and for a moment at least they reflect upon God and why they are here. But nevertheless, they are still overly focused upon this world alone. It takes a withdrawal of the life energy. If you think about the life energy coming in through the base of your skull, at the back of your head, it comes into the brain and it electrifies the brain. Now we think of all the biochemical actions that are constantly going on in this body. And to the physical scientists, consciousness and mind and awareness are all a product of these physiological actions. Take away the physiological actions and consciousness dies. So goes the purely physical science. But there is a more refined science, a higher science. And that science tells us that consciousness is pre-existence. Now we can read the words, but how do we know the truth of this? And it is because when we dive deep within consciousness, suddenly it opens new doors, doors of revelation, doors of truth. And we suddenly know that we existed before this life. In my journey in God, I've had such times where I have seen what was life before I came into this body. I knew that when I came into this body, I was anticipating what this life would bring. And I was actually not thrilled about it. I knew that in many ways it would be a difficult life. It'd be a very challenging life. And I had, if I just had my own thoughts about it, I would have stayed where I was, which is much more comfortable and easy. But I knew that this was something that was needed for my soul's development. And so I entered into my mother's womb, into the body that was developing and growing there. And it's a fascinating journey, as God showed me, because as your own particular pattern impresses itself upon the developing fetus, the zygote, and then the fetus, and then as it develops into this burgeoning young person, it begins to influence the genetic makeup. It's not that new genes are added, but it switches certain genes on, other genes are not switched on. as it matches your own consciousness, your own needs in this world. It seems completely unfair that a child may be born blind or disabled in some way that other people are not when we come into this world. Now, there's a funny story of mother with a devotee, and they were in a car looking for a parking space at a mall. And mother that directed the devotee, she said, well, just park in that space. And he said, well, mother, that's for disabled people. And mother said, well, in this body, we're all disabled, so go ahead and take it. And so they went ahead and parked there. Unfortunately, they didn't get a ticket. And it's true in that sense that we are all disabled in this body. We do not have access to all of our higher functions. This is not an absolute sense because we can activate that. But our past karma, those things that we have put into action through past lives and even earlier in this own life, start to have consequences. We think we can outrun things. Sometimes people get into a point of despair. They get depressed. They think that life is terrible as it is. They no longer see the sacredness or the beauty of it. So they just want out. Many times they are anticipating what will come and thinking that they are not up to it. And God gave me a wonderful revelation about that. He showed me that if we try to anticipate trouble, that many times we just don't know how we could ever endure it. If you think about people who have been in a state of starvation, people who have been in concentration camps, people who have been in really tough straits, perhaps through illness and otherwise, that you try to project yourself into those situations and you just think, I don't have the strength to do that. But what God showed me is that grace is there in equal abundance to meet and exceed whatever difficulty that you are in. Because you are not in that difficulty in that moment, you may not have direct access to the strength, to the guidance, to the comfort that will come to you when you are, so you can't hardly imagine it. But if you know that this is the case, then you will overcome, you will persevere, and you will keep going because God is within you. And when the moment is right, God will withdraw your life from this body. And then it will be done, but it will be done correctly. You think of Jesus being in the garden there in Gethsemane, and what torture he went through because he knew what was coming. In that moment, he was not in dire straits, but he knew that it was coming. And he didn't want to go through it. If it be possible, O Father, O Baba, let this cup pass from me. Such was his deep, sincere prayer. But most importantly, what came after it? But not my will, but thy will be done. This is most important because we come full circle from the Garden of Eden, in which man and woman went about doing what they wanted to do, yet going against God's will. And as a result of that, they removed themselves from the idyllic Garden of Eden in which they existed, in which they communed with God, in which God walked within the garden and spoke with them and talked with them day to day. Now, this is a symbolic story. When we are in total God communion, and when we choose to go against the inner guidance because we want to, or we want to avoid some pain or some difficult situation, and as a result of that, we remove ourselves from God. Now, the way the story is told, God evicts Adam and Eve out of the garden. But this is not really how it should be told. It really should be told that they took themselves out of the garden as a result of what they have done. So God will give you what you need. And there are times when people, because they're anticipating things, they just want it all done with. All the pain, all the suffering, so they think. Down through the years, I worked with many people who had consistent and persistent suicidal thinking. And inevitably, it was not an emotional reaction, it was a thing of will. They calculated that if they took their life, then their suffering would be over. So I presented them this possibility. I said, what if that's not true? What if it is that your troubles are not over? In fact, you've only added to your troubles by taking this action. And they would really think about it. And they say, well, I wouldn't want that, and I wouldn't want to do that. And so we must think about, isn't it better to pay the price now? To go through what God has presented to us, pay off the bill, pay off the debt, so that we might be debt-free going from here on out. And this is something that we can do just simply by accepting the situation that God has placed us in. There had been a woman who had been wanting to come to spiritual talks. She had somehow heard about me. And yet every time that she did, her treatment for her cancer interfered because she was not well. She was in the hospital. And one day someone came and said, she would really like to meet with you. Would you go to the hospital? I said, well, of course I would. So I went to the hospital and I met with her. She had but 2 weeks to live, it turned out. And she sat there. She was completely devoid of all hair on her head, eyebrows, everything, because of the treatment she was going through. She was rather bloated up. Her skin was a terrible color of almost green. And I thought, this poor lady. And I asked her how she was doing, and she said, you know, in this moment, I'm okay. But she had something that was bothering her. She had had a son, and there were two things that she felt very, very sorry about. And she had a hard time forgiving herself for. And so we went through the forgiveness exercise, and she was able to forgive herself for both of these incidents. And then she said, now I am ready to die. She said, but I'm worried about how bad will this get? And I said to her, I said, most people would look at you right now and think this is as bad as it gets. It can't get any worse than this. And yet you're asking, how bad will it get? She was in really tough shape, but she said, for today, I'm okay. If we can really live in the moment, if we can open ourselves to the great life force that comes from God and allow him to comfort us. Many people get fearful. They get angry about their situation in life. They don't like what's been given to them. And so one of the great powers that we have when all else fails is we have the power to withhold. You see that in marriage and close relationships oftentimes. You don't give me what I want, so I'm not going to give you what you want. That's withholding. And pretty soon, a marriage will be completely devoid of life or pleasure or anything good because both are withholding from each other anything that the other wants. When we take the attitude that we are of service to the other individual, how can I serve God in you? That doesn't mean catering to every single whim. It means serving God in them. What is for their highest light? What is there for highest good? And you may say, well, how do I know what that is? You go inside and you listen to God. You don't act out of anger. You don't act out of fear. There is but one measurement for you in life, and that is, what do you do? What do you say? How do you act? You can blame the rest of the world for how they treat you. and what others do that's wrong to you. And you can use that as an excuse, but it doesn't wash with your own soul. Because at one time you will die and you will leave the body, and you have nothing but yourself. And you have to face yourself and what you did in this life. And it has no reference to what anybody else did or said to you. You are accountable to God alone. And in that moment, God is not judging you. But truth is, and you know the truth in your deep recesses of your soul. And so if you have held a grudge, if you have held on to anger, if out of fear you have not lived fully, that's on you, no one else. And you may say, well, I was raised this way or that way. True enough, those can present special challenges. But the challenges are yours to overcome, not for you to correct the rest of the world. And so you get on with life. You get on with moving forward. You get on with becoming a whole being, one with God. And as you do so, you free yourself from all of these other things. They no longer have a power on you. They no longer have a hold on you. Because now you are a jiva mukta, freed while living, a soul that is free. And this is what you have come to do. You're not here to correct the rest of the world. We can look at others' behavior and learn from it. And look at someone, how they are perhaps living their life not properly. And we can see what the consequences are. You know, someone who is constantly angry, who is constantly finding fault with others, they are not a happy person. So we can look at somebody else's life and we can judge it. We can evaluate it on this perspective. What of me is being manifest in that person? In other words, is there something in me that judges other people? Is there something in me that withholds myself? I remember there's a time in my life when I realized I didn't live life fully. I was always holding back. I had ever since I was a child. It was a habit that I had come into this life with. It was a protective habit. But God asked me, he said, if you do not live fully now, then when? When do you give yourself permission to step into life fully? You have one foot in and one foot out. And therefore, you don't make real progress. And I had to determine in myself, I have to put both feet in. I have to commit myself. It's easy to stand back and be a critic and find fault with everything and everyone else. That's an easy thing to do. We can even have a kind of false criticism of ourselves, a kind of false humility where we blame everything on ourselves. And that was much more my pattern, where I had this shame base. And I had to come to grips with that. I had to learn that this life was about learning and about growing. Shame prevents learning. It wants you to hide into the closet. It wants you to hide things that you have done and said into the closet. It makes you feel that you are forever doing the wrong thing, or it should have been done sooner, or should have been done better. And on it goes. And it's not around learning. It's around beating yourself over the head. And perhaps it's a defensive motion. Before somebody else beats you over the head, you'll do it to yourself. But what it doesn't do is reflect God inside of you. It doesn't allow the great light of divinity to glow within your own heart and to inform your own mind about what you should do in showing discernment. It prevents you from learning. So if we truly want to be wise, we have to become simple, become childlike. Jesus said here in Luke 10, behold, I give unto you power to tread on serpents and scorpions and over all power over the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you. That's quite a thing, isn't it? It's quite a promise. You have power over all of your enemies. There's nothing that can hurt you. Then he goes on to say, notwithstanding in this, rejoice not. In other words, don't get overjoyed about having this kind of power, because that's not where you're headed. Jesus says that the spirits are subject to you. Rejoice not that the spirits are subject to you, that you have power over them, but rather rejoice because your names are written in heaven. What is heaven? Heaven lives the higher consciousness within you. Your name is written there. You have access now to the higher intelligence, higher consciousness, higher bliss, the ever new joy of God. That's what you should rejoice in, not having powers. Isn't that wonderful how he does that? And then it goes on. In that hour, Jesus rejoiced in spirit and said, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hath revealed them unto babes. Even so, Father, for it seemed good in thy sight. So in order to learn real wisdom, then we must become as a child. You must become open and simple, not calculating. That's what he means by wise in this case. It's, if you will, a kind of lawyeristic mind that's always looking at the angle. How can I get out of this? How can I hide this? When you become simple, when you become open toward God, then you let down all your guards. You let down everything that has kept you separate from him. You say, Lord, come into my heart and give me true love for thee. Come into my mind and give me true wisdom and discernment. With my reasoning mind, it is always limited. I can never have access to all of the facts, to everything that is required in order to make proper judgment. You alone, by definition, are what is in connection with all of life, and therefore do what is for the highest good of everybody concerned. Then you attune yourself to what God is guiding and directing you to do. You open yourself in a childlike way. And if you make a mistake, your sincerity is your best ally in this case. Because with your sincerity, as you step forward, trusting in God that he is guiding you, that he is leading you, directing you in all ways, if you make a mistake and act out of your own desire nature, out of your own fear, out of anger, you will know it. You will start losing connection with God. You will start feeling oftentimes down in your solar plexus, that place where your ribs split apart in front of you, there's a sensitive nerve plexus there. And it is a place of intuition. And you will start to feel something's out of sorts here. Something's not quite right. I'm off. Before I felt that I was right on track. Now I'm off. And if you are sincere, you will backtrack and you will find out where you diverted from God's will. And then he will take you in the right course. And then you'll feel it and you go, yes, this is right. Now, from a reasoning standpoint, there's a saying that when you're faced with a choice, do which is hardest, because that's probably what God would like for you. Now, that doesn't always go down so easily. And there can be a truth to that, because we are always seeking the easy way. And that's not always God's way. Doesn't mean that he always wants you to walk on the thorns and on the sharp rocks. But he will want to take you along in the path of truth. And that's not always easy or well received by the world around you. And so, open yourself in that innocence, in that childlike nature. Be bold enough and courageous enough to step forward, even when the world might not well receive the way that God is directing you. One of the greatest tests that I ever had is when I had to go against what all the people around me thought. And even to some degree, what I thought. Because God was very definitely directing me in that way. And I had to let go of all of the approbation that this world has to give. And even, as I say, to some degree, my own. But yet I knew deep down inside, this is absolutely the way that God wanted me to go. So we get tested along the way when we follow the path of wisdom. When we stay true to it, when we stay in the purity of that truth, we will then overcome everything. And we will no longer live in fear. We will no longer react out of anger. We will go exactly as God directs us, moment to moment. There's an interesting question that I received by email. I thought I would share with you some of this. Let's see if I have them. Let's see. I'm missing the first part of it. So this comes from a devotee. Notice several times you describe very powerful experiences as God talking to you or revealing to you. This stood out since it appears to be a state of duality, since in reality there is no God who talks to you, there is only God. Are you using this as a teaching tool, or is God speaking to you, your experience as described? Or perhaps both or neither. Mother used some form of this description as well. In other words, when I would say God showed me or God told me, it implies a duality. And so what is true monotheistic spirit, you may say? And I responded, God is both personal and impersonal. He may come as a voice in the mind, a revelatory vision, a direct thought transference, so many ways of transmitting divine consciousness to the devotee. God is also known when the little I merges into the great I am, as the aspirant achieves oneness with the supreme consciousness of God. Now there are not two, but only one. God is both personal and impersonal, and may continue to manifest as both, even after the aspirant achieves oneness with him. This is the Heavenly Father's play, the Divine Mother's Leela. With union or yoga consciousness stabilized, then when manifesting as a human identity, there is no sense of separation from the self. It is a play upon the surface of the waters, while in the depths, divine oneness is ever undisturbed. Yet, as Mother says, even for the universally realized soul to manifest on the dual plane of consciousness, there must be some ignorance, some separation assumed. So, the God-realized human assumes some form of ego as a devotee of God, a servant of God, a teacher of God, etc. The teacher appears to teach God. That is to someone playing a role as a human being separate from him. Yet none are ever separated from God, for he is all in all. It is all his play. A strange irony exists for the monists in India, for they say that God beyond creation is real, all else is illusion. The monist actually creates a duality by saying, this is God and this is not God. Yet this world exists. And the monist is speaking to who? If there is no other, then why say anything at all? Papa, Master, and Mother all say that God is both personal and impersonal. This is true monism. Yeah, monism is the oneness of God. And so many monists in India will say, this world is an illusion. It's an illusion. And a God alone that is above this creation in pure oneness alone is what is real. Now, it is true that as you are aspiring for God realization, you may very well go through a state in which you feel that this world is not quite real. It feels like a shadowy existence, like things are just an outline of an idea. And what is true and what is real is the spiritual regeneration that is going on inside of you. You feel the presence of God, the bliss of God, the oneness with God. And that feels real, and the world feels like an illusion. This is going through a jnani state. And this is discernment. Oh, God is real. The spirit is real. But this is the state of the bhakti as you aspire going into the state of jnani. But then you go into the state of the parabhakti, the supreme bhakta, the supreme lover of God. And for that one, they then open their eyes and they see that this world is a manifestation, an expression of God, that God is scintillating as the core essence of every part of this creation. He is in the heart of every being whom you meet. And therefore, you don't see this world as an illusion any longer. You now see it as a perfect expression of God. And that is the higher state. That is true monism. When you can withdraw your consciousness and merge into oneness with God, in which there is no two, there is only one. There is no separation whatsoever. But in order to come down into this plane of duality, into this relative sense, where there is good and bad, high and low, hot and cold, all the different opposites, then you have to bring yourself into this state where you can operate in this world. And so to a certain degree, you feel that there is a separateness. There is an I and there is a you. And yet it is just a play upon the surface. It doesn't have any lasting hold on you. The moment that that is no longer needed, you simply withdraw. There's no karma associated with this because it is done out of the prompting of God. He has brought you to manifest yourself in this material world. And therefore, you feel it is only His will. If He gives you pain, that is Him giving you this pain. If He gives you sorrow, it is He Himself who is giving you this sorrow in compassion for this world. You no longer live for yourself, you live for God alone. And God expresses Himself through you to this world, because that is a way for Him to express His greater truth and His greater life and His greater reality into this material being, so that He might awaken Himself in slumbering mankind. So you see, then both become true. God is within, beyond this creation, the supreme abode. And He is also manifesting as the footstool of God, this creation, and everything in it. So as I've written here, a strange irony exists for the monists in India. They say that God is beyond creation is real, all else is illusion. The monist actually creates a duality by saying this is God and this is not God. Yet the world exists, and the monist is speaking to who? If there is no other, then why say anything at all? Papa, master, mother, all say that God is both personal and impersonal. This is true monism. The idea of separateness itself is the illusion. It is not this world, you see. That is the difficulty, that is the problem. We oftentimes see it that way because as we try to focus on God, it feels like it's this world that is pulling at us, that is drawing us out into separateness. We have a wonderful meditation and we feel peaceful and uplifted and joyful in God. And then we start to move out into this world and the telephone rings, or we get into our car, we get to work, and gradually the world draws us back out into this worldly existence. It is this sense, this illusion, that this world is separate from God. We do not yet see the reality that God exists as this world. And as such, when we open our eyes and move out into this world, we're moving out into God. When we see those who are perhaps not living as they should be, as a perfect expression of God, then we are here to serve them. But it really is all His play, because everything comes from God. Everything returns to God. Everything is perfect in God. And you might say, well, what about suffering? What about violence? What about wars? What about suffering of others? That is God feeling compassion through your heart for all of these situations. So what do you do about it? Do you serve God in the best way that you know how in all that you meet? Do you pray for God when these situations come to mind or when you see them? You know, every time that I hear a fire siren or a siren of any policeman going someplace, I pray for those who are the recipients of the action. If somebody has been in an accident, if they've had a heart attack, if whoever they're going to help, I pray for that individual. I pray for the helpers. I pray for the responders going that are there to help, that they might fulfill the highest light of God. And you can hear that siren, you can just think, oh dear, somebody else is having a problem. But you can also go to work and pray for those individuals. Give them your part of God. Give them your part of God. Because God can give to you in such great abundance to this world if you focus on Him. When you see yourself as a conduit, and the higher you rise up in Him in meditation consciousness, the more you can express His divinity in this world. You can be such a great asset. You might be, perhaps, relegated to a hospital bed, or to a wheelchair, or to very limited activities in this world. But you can always pray for God, pray to God for this world. You can always manifest that light within you. I've described how being up in high in the Himalayas, how I experienced these great yogis sending out blessings to this world, and it came wave after wave after wave, powerful waves, going out to this world. These individuals were deeply focused upon God, being conduits for God. And as a result, they were sending out tremendously powerful vibrations to this world. You see, it's not just, that's the material mind who thinks, it is just what I can do for another, or money that I can give for another, or service that I can do for another in the body. The greatest service that you can do is to see God in everyone and everything. And as a result of that, you transmit something powerful, the God thought, the God energy that manifests through you. You see what a tremendous thing this is. There's a story I read recently where an individual had meningitis, a very particular kind, that had disabled him in his body and even in his mind for a while, but eventually his mind came back, but he couldn't communicate in any way whatsoever. And he lived this way, and he grew despondent, and he just didn't even want to think, and he withdrew his mind from this world completely, just went into a kind of blankness. And then at some point, he thought, this isn't right. It's not right. And he started thinking on this world. And his mind started to activate again because he is bringing new, fresh life energy into it. And eventually, He is able to communicate with those around him. And then they realize that he was no longer simply unconscious and in a coma, but he was coming out of it. And together they worked in order to bring him. And now he is married to a beautiful young woman. He's still in a wheelchair, and it's still not ideal, but he's working on it. He's working on it. And you see how far he came from a totally unconscious state to where he made himself conscious once more, and then started guiding the life energy back into his body. Doctors have their opinions, and they're based on experience. They're based on percentages, but they are never actual fact until it comes to bear. And so we can take information that a doctor may say about a condition that we have, but we don't have to accept it as a final fact, because God is ever in play. And that potentiality for rising above, for having power over all things, and nothing can hurt you, is ever present. Now, it may be that God wants you to go through a particular situation. There may be things that God has you simply surrender to, because that is Him acting, and that is wisdom in that moment. And there are other times when you fight, and you fight with everything that you have. How do you know which to do? Because you are tuning into Him. You are increasing your wisdom quotient, your ability to know and act upon wisdom. And as a result of that, you fulfill the highest good, not only for yourself, but everybody around you. So let us think on this. Let us contemplate, how do we make decisions in this world, day to day? Do we open ourselves to that wisdom quotient, that which is beyond the reasoning mind? It's all right to use the reasoning mind as far as it goes, but we will always bump up against its limitations. Are we cultivating the divine mind, being directed by God within, and knowing what is truth and how to act upon that truth? That is a much superior way to be in this world. So let us take this and really go to work on ourselves. Find out if we're somehow progressing or stunting our growth. And when we find ourselves stalemated and not growing further, let us really go to work on ourselves. Go deeper, soar higher, until you break open whatever barrier is keeping you from knowing God and His direction in life. Now, God's direction is always highest and best. But given a situation, we may have to make a choice. And so we go according to the highest light that we know, according to our reason, according to our feeling. And we will know as we proceed down that, whether that was the right decision. We will learn from that. So let us keep going forward, always attuning ourselves to the highest consciousness. And in this way, we will attain that highest state, where as we act, we know that we're acting as God would choose within us. We don't just get a direction and then act on it in separation from God. We feel God every step of the way. We feel we are His instrument. There's nothing greater in this life. It's what I hope and I pray for you, that you have that perfect apprehension of divine direction, and that God may ever shine inside of you. With all love, give you my pronouns. I bow to God within you. And that God may awaken Himself in you to the fullest extent, and you may know Him truly and perfectly. every moment of every day. Be it so.